America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Hi, I'm Larry Rifkin, and welcome back to America Trends. Now that everyone seems to be streaming first-run movies and more digital entertainment than ever before from their home, what's to become of big movie complexes? Questions arose about their viability prior to the pandemic, and now, a year and a half later, virtually closed down during that period, what is their future? People have written off the theaters before, but they seem to have a place, even if it's only for dating couples or big action thrillers. Let's have some fun today, discussing the future of the movie theater on America Trends.
With me on America Trends is Scott Higgins, and he is a professor, but also the director of the College of Film and the Moving Image at Wesleyan University. Obviously, the first question that anybody would have, given where you teach, is, did you teach Lin-Manuel Miranda?
I wish I had. I did not. I started teaching here in 2000, and I think we may have overlapped maybe a year. So, no, I didn't get a chance to teach him. Though, he did take film classes. He was close to my my boss and the former director, Jeanine Basinger.
Yeah, Jeanine Basinger. I was going to ask how he did, but I'm sure he did quite well in whatever courses he was taking. Well, let me ask you this. I got you here to talk about the future of film, but also to talk about the business of film in the context of what we've been going through during this period of COVID-19. And there are a lot of people, you've been quoted as saying that theaters have been dying since the end of World War II. There are certain people who think that COVID-19 has caused an interruption that we haven't seen before and that it might be fatal on some level. What do you think?
No, I hope it's not fatal, but I fear it. So I agree that theaters have been declining. And, you know, to go back to World War II, that's an extreme statement that makes a good quotation, but basically it says that in 1948, they're selling about 90 million tickets a week, 80 to 90 million tickets a week to movies, which is the all-time high. And ever since then, it has been declining and declining and declining. And we're now in a point that other technologies have come to the fore that allow people to watch movies at home and experience them without going to the theater. And that was already doing damage to movie theaters. The main time that movie theaters would make money were the summer months, the tentpole films, basically the Marvel films that we all know and some of us love. Beyond that, the studios were kind of scrambling to make a profit on any film. So you have Christmas and summer. And unfortunately, what's happened is COVID has ripped the audiences away from those two tentpole seasons. Then it was most obvious this summer when some streamers, I guess it's Warner Brothers, was showing on HBO Max the new Wonder Woman film, which is a terrible film, but it's a terrible film that would have had a excellent opening weekend, and that would have powered that film's popularity for the rest of the market, and it would have powered its film's popularity for overseas and for, you know, video and streaming. And it, you know, could have given Warner Brothers quite a bit of money for not very good movie. Well, you watch it on television. There's no way to hide the flaws behind the spectacle or behind the feeling of an event. And it dies on the vine. And so what I'm concerned about is that COVID has undercut, or maybe it's taught folks that it's not just we don't go to the movies anymore because I could see it on TV, right? It's more that there are these big seasons where the bulk of the money is made, where the industry creates a lot of excitement over going to the movies. And having lost two of those now, summer and winter, they're going to have a hard time recovering. At the same time, the big multiplexes, they are having a lot of trouble. Who knows if they will survive? I know that there have been some bailouts, and there's hope that AMC and Regal can survive. But we're going to lose theaters. And again, it comes to the summer season, because when you think about a 20 screen multiplex in July, they're showing maybe six films, right? Using all of those screens. And they need all those screens, and that's the business. You get lots of tickets for very few films. Already in the fall, they were having trouble making ends meet and keeping all those screens filled, and in the spring. So already I think that the theaters were not a thriving business, but they were a surviving business. And this pressure has really, it's really done damage, I'm afraid.
Well, some of the numbers really bear this out. Star Wars, the adaptation that came out in January of 2020, it was $34.5 million on the first weekend. Then Wonder Woman, the one you referred to, 1984, in January 2021, half that. In June, all 14 of the releases that were current did less than $1 million in total. Now, we know this is during a pandemic, but as you say, there are other factors that are playing into this, and the whole notion of streaming. Now, I know in the past people have thought that various media would supersede and overwhelm film, but the streaming component today, how different a rival is this? And in certain cases, it's not even a rival except within a company, because it's between their movie division outside and their movie division within.
Right. So they still have a revenue stream, even if they're going on streaming instead of into theaters. I think it comes down to exclusivity of the product, that you can drive people to a theater or to streamers if that's the only place that it is available. Right. And that's kind of how the summer film or any film works. Exclusively available in theaters, that's where people will go. But that's a big lift. You have to change your week. You have to decide if you're going to, like, well, today I've decided if I'm going to leave my house, but on a regular day, get somebody to watch the kids, if you have kids, you know, gas up the car, drive somewhere, and sit down and watch a movie. That is a chain of maybe, I don't know, 6, 7, 10 actions you have to take to go see a movie. The alternative, don't make any decisions and sit down on your couch as you do, you know, every day at 6. And, you know, the availability of different titles in front of you in streaming makes it a tougher and tougher equation, I think. It's a tougher sell to get somebody out of their house and to a theater. On one hand, this, I think, is all going to go away when the studios decide, oh, theaters are open. We're not going to be releasing them on Netflix and HBO Max and Disney Plus. You'll have to see it in the cinema. So that means, sure, it's exclusive, and they can build a lot of excitement over a movie through advertising blitzes. But has behavior changed? I mean, for me, that's the question. Have we, at this point, figured out that we can have a lot of choice by staying at home? That you know, maybe I can get my fine night's entertainment without going out to the theaters, and that window between the theatrical exhibition and streaming is getting narrower and narrower. So how long do I have to wait for it to come to the couch? I think streamers have really benefited, because there are different kinds of films right now, some that would have been released in theaters and now are on HBO Max, right? Or Netflix. Then there are also films that were always going to HBO Max or Netflix or Hulu, Only now they could pretend that they were going to be in the theater. So Netflix announced they're going to have a new film every week. And that kind of thing is going to be, I think, less appealing when people realize that the every film every week is, it's an made-for-TV movie. Or it's a movie that, you know, I wouldn't really bother with. And there's going to be, once the pandemic is over, crosstalk and conflict between advertising campaigns. And people will probably not listen to the Netflix advertising campaign. So, you know, I think it's a mixed bag. I think that the streamers have gotten a boost from the pandemic, both in showing films that we would have seen in theaters, but also pretending other films are more vital than they are. At the same time, the movies that I really want to see right now, the movies that are Oscar contenders, those are on streamers. Mm-hmm. And those are also films that don't have the box office legs to make a lot of money unless they get an Oscar. So at some point, it's going to make more sense for the studios to release. I mean, they tend to be mid-budget films with smaller audiences that have prestige. At some point, it's going to make sense for producers to put them straight to streamers. So they've already done it with Roma. That trend is going to continue.
And I believe this year, Nomadland came out on Hulu immediately. A lot of people think that it has all kinds of awards written all over it. But let me go back to the movie experience that we shared in the past in the theater. And because I want to find out what's really happening here. Is it that perhaps we got tired of that experience because there are a lot of unruly people? There have been some terrible, tragic events at theaters. There's just annoyances at the theater because certain people cannot stay within themselves. We've got phones going off and the like. And then we purchased so much entertainment for our home, and we're adding streaming service after streaming service. And, of course, Disney is spending now on its streaming service, I think, $176 billion for content. So are they just making it too alluring, or is the price point something that we just say, hey, I've got it all invested here, I'll wait until that big motion picture that's got a lot of whiz-bang comes to my home because I can still feel the whiz-bang without the annoyance?
So I think there's truth in all of that. And boy, that's depressing. Thanks for laying it out for me that way. But, you know, the one thing that I would say is people do want to get out of the house, and they want a reason to be in a communal space. And I think the proof of that is I'm going to go back to the big tentpole films again, actually to the Marvel films and to Avengers Endgame and the one before it, and Avengers Infinity War. Those were huge, huge movies on every screen in the U.S., and there was nothing like seeing them in person for a communal experience. Marvel has managed to kind of hybridize television and film. So the films, they're not standalone. They're a chapter of a serial. The audience has been, you know, pining to see the next film and been involved in, you know, conversations on the web and in publications and with one another about what's going to happen, who's going to survive, who's going to die. And seeing those movies with a live audience opening weekend, and actually I think it went more than just the opening weekend, like through the whole first 2 weeks, it was an amazing experience. You know, the audience would cheer when the theme song for Wakanda came on the soundtrack. Not Wakanda, just the theme song. So, you know, for me, that's all very hopeful because you have a huge group of very literate filmgoers who are enwrapped and paying attention and responding. And in some sense, they are giving back to cinema what cinema loses on television, which is it's both a communal and a personal experience that, when you're watching a film with an audience, you're in a silent conversation with every other member of that audience. If they laugh at a joke and you don't, is there something wrong with you? Was it funny? If you don't laugh? And for me, the perfect movie experience watching it with an audience, is this feeling that that movie knows my secrets. I see myself in that movie. And how did they know that those are my secret desires? It's speaking directly to me. At the same time, I'm with an audience of hundreds of people who are also being spoken directly, who also have their secrets being put up on the screen. And that is something that we lose, that you cannot get, I don't think, in home viewing. But not all films benefit from that. The kind of films that you're describing, actually, the Oscar films, the kind of auteur and art films, mm-hmm. those have for a long time been consigned to small houses, often bad projection and uncomfortable seats. And in some cases, I would rather watch those alone and at home. I feel, though, that I missed something by seeing Nomadland on a small screen. It's a film that's full of ideas, and it's a film that I think is, it's a small film and an intensely moving film. And a lot of that comes across, right? It's also a gorgeously shot movie with location footage in the Badlands. And I could feel as I was watching it, it plays on a contrast between the confines of the van, the inside of the van, and the expanse of the exterior. Well, when I watch it on TV at home, I know that's important, but I don't feel it. Right? All of which is to say, God, I hope we still keep going to the theater. But you have a point. It's really expensive. And I think as long, you know, if it's a rational decision and folks say, well, I've got all this in front of me now, I might as well stay home, then cinema's in trouble. The benefit is, entertainment and our love of cinema has never been a rational matter, right? So, you know, it will survive. I talked to a director recently, a Hollywood director, and he has a much more depressing view of things than I do. He said, he was talking actually not just to me, but to a group of college students, and he said, look, your kids, and he's talking to these 20-year-olds in the Zoom audience, your kids won't have the experience of going to the cinema the way you did. You grew up going to the movies. That's gone. And that was really gutting to me. I think he's probably right. I think that in big cities and people with money and people who care or have this, you know, tradition in the family of going to the cinema, they'll be able to go see movies. But it's going to be very expensive. And the massive of Americans who only see one movie once a year, and it will be that blockbuster, not going to go anymore. I mean, that's my thought. My worst, it's probably true. Cinema is going to survive in captivity. Film going is going to survive in these small areas where people who are willing to pay and willing to go, they can have that experience. But it's not going to be an every week option, and I'm afraid it's going to cease to be the current of conversation that we share with one another. You know, did you see this? You know,
well, today, I mean, when we look at it, Professor Higgins, I mean, you look at the fact that we used to have that communal sense, even if it was the next day around a water cooler. And today, and I hate to use this term, but when you look at television, and with all the services available, and by the way, many of them are very good and have some incredible options in terms of dramatic work, but they're vomiting up material such that none of us is really watching what the other person is watching. We're asking them, hey, did you catch this on Netflix? I know it's buried under binge-worthy or it's some other category, but most of us aren't watching the same things as we used to.
Well, that's a great point. And in fact, though, it has a benefit because we are all connected through the internet. And so we can find like subcultures and communities who are devoted to that one particular weird show, that there's kind of an identity group formation that goes on around fan communities of particular shows. But it's not the lingua franca around the water cooler. And my other concern about streaming is the more content there is, the less you're going to watch. Because at this moment, there's too much to choose from. We've all had the Netflix night where you don't watch anything. They just look at, okay, here's an option. Maybe I'll just watch The Office again. That as long as like the old and familiar is there, I can do that again. I have this experience with my students. I teach film history, and there is this and completely excusable belief that all of film history is available somewhere. I mean, if that film was made and was important, then I must be able to find it on a streamer or on the web. In fact, that's of course not true, and it narrows what we see of the past. And even though it's available, it doesn't mean people will actually go and see it. Not to be an old man, but to be an old man, when I was growing up and somebody was showing a 16-millimeter print of The Third Man and you couldn't see it anywhere else, you went. Right? You went because it was available and because it was shown. Today, what's going to get you to watch The Third Man? A teacher has to assign it to you. Unfortunately. So, yeah, I find that my students are sort of, their viewing is increasingly limited to only what we assign them. And there's a feeling that if it's important, I'll get it, you know. So that going out to find, just seeking out a film, that cinephilia, I think that might be on the decline.
I know that we talked about these mega complexes, problems they're having. You talked briefly about these single screens, though they are beautiful architecturally and really interesting places often. I remember one in Key West that became a nonprofit, and I loved the whole ambiance, and they would talk about the film after and such.
Mm-hmm.
I want to go to another form that is so old. Going back to 1950, you had 2,000 drive-in theaters. They were in operation. 1958, you had more than 44,000. And then you had all the suburbanites. The car was the king. Now, it had something of a resurgence during the pandemic. Is that just a fleeting thing?
Yeah, I'm afraid that's a novelty. The beauty of the drive-in was that it was lifted by demographic changes in the U.S. The white flight from the cities, movement into suburbs, away from the theaters, and a lot of people are having babies. And so it just got harder to get out. So in the 1950s, you see the growth of drive-ins, but you also see the growth of things like mini golf. I mean, for a while, mini golf is a huge competitor for maybe like a month in 1953, but a competitor for people's dollars. And of course, television, which takes the territory radio had taken and then deepens it. So there was a moment when the drive-in was a good way to compete with television to get people into theaters when farmland was cheap and also near the new subdivision. And so then it became a kind of a teenage hangout. And we all, like, don't have to explain why teenagers want to get out of the house, right? And that's not going to go away. And yet, teenagers have other things to do and other excuses to meet up now. And we don't have the car culture that we used to. And between you and me, the romance of the drive-in, there's a lot of romance there, but it's kind of a crappy way to see a movie. I mean, if you really want to see a movie.
Well, the audio was horrible.
Yeah, you have to have a clean windshield, and you probably have some cars in front of you. It's not,
but
it's
we
not
move
the
past the drive-in. But I want to ask you about, there was an article in The Nation magazine, and it said the COVID-19 pandemic is providing a perfect cover for media giants bent on replacing theatrical movie going with streaming at home. And the headline was, "Movie theaters aren't dying, they're being murdered." That this is really a conscious effort to move everything back into the home by a lot of the same companies that traverse one part of the universe and another and end up in all of our lives in so many ways.
Yeah, that seems a bit on the side of, not conspiracy theory, but on the side of giving the companies too much credit for being able to plan this sort of thing. You know, theatrical is a revenue stream, and it's a revenue stream that they know how to work. Disney knows exactly how to have an advertising campaign to get people in seats on opening weekend. I don't see a company willingly sacrificing that or using the pandemic as a cover to kill it. But I do see, you know, the pandemic happened, and they are very smart at figuring out ways to keep profit rolling in. So I don't think it's in anybody's best interest to kill theatrical exhibition. They make more money that way, as I said, just as a as an advertising platform for their properties, not to kill it entirely. However, there's a future in which some of these companies, Disney, for instance, owns theaters. They used to be against the law. The antitrust law in 1948 stipulated that distributors and producers cannot also be exhibitors, and they had to be separated from one another. Mm-hmm. And under Trump, that law has gone away. So now we're in a position, as far as I understand, we're in a position where Disney can, or another company, Disney's the biggest, can start buying cinemas. If they buy a cinema, then it becomes part of their rollout plan. They don't have to rely on other exhibitors, rely on contracts with them, and they can charge what they want. They can keep those cinemas open all year or only open them when they have big blockbusters to show, and they can strictly control how that advertising campaign is going to hit. Actually, you know, the theater and also subscriptions for Disney Plus. I mean, it gives them a frightening amount of leverage. That's more conspiracy talk. I don't know if that's...
Well, no, that has been speculated. Has been speculated in other writing that Disney and Warner want to drive these independent movie chains out of business, set up their own chains. And that brings about the whole idea of a duopoly where, say, Disney and Warner or Netflix uses the big screens just to showcase a certain content, treating the theaters as a lost leader. And then they want you for the subscription, because I see this happening with a lot of things where, you know, you buy a printer, but that's not what you're buying. You're buying an ongoing ink contract, and that they just throw in the printer. So I'm wondering if that is the philosophy. We want you on our books year-round.
We'll have to time. This is the old yarn. The time will tell. I mean, I also have to believe there's a limit to market growth through subscriptions. That is also a bubble, and it's already, you know, I think being threatened by just the number of services available. I have to buy Paramount and Disney and Netflix and Hulu. I mean, there has to be a point at which people stop subscribing. Or in Netflix's case, everybody subscribed already. So how do you grow that market? Now, I understand that Netflix actually has still a lot of markets to grow. Their goal is to reach a market saturation that's similar to cable TV in, I think, the early 90s, which was huge. And they're not there yet. No company is what cable used to be. So they can still sell more and more subscriptions. But I just have to believe that in the end, they're going to be making choices between $5 a month from somebody who might drop this, right? And $20 per seat at a theater. And, you know, so in other words, who knows? But I am concerned about the contraction of the market, and I guess you're right. It's not even an oligopoly anymore. It would be a duopoly.
What about all the foreign product that is now finding its way onto Netflix, onto HBO Max, and, of course, then those markets themselves being open and available to these providers? How important is that? I mean, we saw last year with the Academy Awards, the first foreign film to win the best movie, Parasite. So what are we looking at here in terms of the merging of content?
That's a great question. There are gatekeepers, and those gatekeepers, I don't think are going to change. So you have Fox Searchlight, you have independent distributors like A24, and also big distributors who pick up foreign films, I guess, and push them into the U.S. They can do that with maybe three or four titles, right? Parasite was one of them. And so it takes concentration to get a lot of American eyes on those movies, but it can be done. And like I say, it's a gatekeeper effect that there's so much content out there. It takes a concerted effort to buy and promote and package a film for, and usually for an award season for the American public. On the other hand, you know, what you also noted was there are more foreign films available to us than ever on Netflix and Hulu and Amazon. And you have to look for them. So the interface you get when you sign on to Amazon, Amazon has a great selection of Indian films, Bollywood, and also of Chinese mainland films. But you have to look for them. Like, you really have to, like, have particular search terms and then search and search and search, and eventually the interface will realize, oh, you like this kind of film, and start recommending them for you. But even that interface, when you sit down and start watching Netflix, that's a gatekeeper, and it's going to push things to you that they think are going to be familiar to you. So actually now is a great time to watch foreign films, especially popular cinemas from other nations. It's there and it's available, but you could tell the way they bury it that they really don't expect anyone. They're not making money off of it. They're not trying to promote it. It's just it's just something that's there. So I recommend using that. Because that's opened up for us.
Well, there's also that concern about how much we're allowing the Chinese market to dominate some editorial decisions, because if there's something that they find objectionable, and it's such a lucrative market potentially that so many movie makers don't want to upset those in power in China. Is that something you worry about?
That's something I've been watching, and my experience so far has been that, yes, there are a few cases where usually it's co-productions made by both an American and a Chinese company that are made so that they gain access to the Chinese market, that they have to play by Chinese rules, right? And there are good examples of that. On the whole, though, my thought about what I know about the American industry and the Chinese industry is that American film producers, boy, they want the Chinese. They want access to the Chinese market. I mean, it has so many screens. And it's going to get even more appealing as screens die in the U.S. There was a huge buildup of screens in China over the last 10 years, and where things like 3D are on the – well, they've been – 3D has been on its way out in America since probably 2013, right? The only reason that a 3D version of film is made today is for the Chinese market, because of all of the investment that has gone into multiplexing and state-of-the-art technology in China. So Hollywood wants China. China has quotas. China is in a buyer's market. They decide how many American films get shown in mainland China. And the government decides which ones get released during their tentpole season, right, which is usually around the Lunar New Year, and which ones don't. I mean, there's a very it is top down controlled. So I actually don't think there's enough flexibility there for it to have that. You know, not that many American or Hollywood producers would consider themselves lucky enough to be able to say, no, I want to please the Chinese government and get that market. I think they would in an instant. Really, I don't think that there's much. This may shock you, but the capitalists don't really care about. They want screens. They want eyeballs. So it's something to watch out for. Though I think that smaller films that take a political stance will be targeted to smaller audiences. So it is the films that are going to play big to huge mega audiences that are going to be the ones that might be censored, or at least their content will be shifted to please state censors in China. Those are also films that are not well known for taking positions or, you know, inspiring political thought.
Now, let me ask you just a couple of questions about what you really love to talk about, not the business of film necessarily, but that's very important, but film. And do a lightning round with me, because this is for fun, and this is to wrap things up, and you've been very generous with your time. What is the greatest movie of all time?
Well, let's a lightning round. And now it becomes, this is a glacier round. 100 favorite movies, and they change depending on who's asking. So, and also how I feel at the moment. I'm really a fan of Best Years of Our Lives. And that's been at the top of my list for the past couple of years now. Probably as we're going through the pandemic and going through the troubles in the U.S. and we've got, you know, being a citizen in America right now is painful, a little less painful for me now than it used to be. Best Years of Our Lives made a huge film directed by William Wyler just after World War II, was the story of soldiers coming back from the front and getting back to life. And it's kind of a handbook to the American dream. This is how things are going to work out after you've had that experience abroad. And it follows four characters who, each of them, you know, one is a banker, one is a guy who was a soda jerk before, one is played by Harold Russell, who was a soldier who lost both hands in training in World War II, and he received a special Oscar for that role. And each of them come back into a small town called Boone City, which I'm not sure they specify where Boone City is, but they go to Boone City, and it's not an easy transition. I mean, it really is a film that's about how hard it is to come back to a world that would have much better time just kind of ignoring you. And yet, despite the hardships and, you know, the trouble finding a job and alcoholism and failed marriages, they're going to make it. Like you leave that film and everything is going to be fine and beautiful. So I highly recommend it.
Can we find that easily?
Best Years of Our Lives? That's a good question. I'm sure it's streaming somewhere. It swept the Academy Awards, so it's everywhere.
What about the best actor or actress in the last 30 years? I mean, lots of people look at De Niro. They look at Pacino, obviously Meryl Streep. I mean, are those conventional or are those correct?
They're probably both. It's so hard to say. So actors are movie stars, right? And every person that you named is both a movie star. Even Meryl Streep, who is like the non-movie star movie star, she's like the actor's movie star. Every one of them, I think, can light up a screen, and they have charisma, and they know how to perform, and, you know, in front of the camera. Streep, I think, covers both sides. I think she's a fine theatrical actress as well. So my standards of like what makes a great film actor, it has to do not with line delivery and not with accents necessarily, but this uncanny ability to know where the camera is and to light up and communicate to the audience on the other side of the camera, right? And for me, the actor who does that especially well right now is Michael B. Jordan. He lights up the screen. He is a movie star. There's just more charisma in his relationship with a camera than I've seen in a long time. But that's me saying, yes, that's a movie star. I think he's a pretty good actor too. But, you know, I think, that's a fine list. Brad Pitt's pretty great.
What about the director? A lot of people look at Spielberg. They look at Scorsese, Lucas. Who's your favorite?
Boy, it varies. I think we're in a place now where, unfortunately, every director wants to be Spielberg or Lucas or Scorsese. In other words, everybody who makes a first film thinks they're also making a masterpiece. And it's a very crowded field. And I think that there are filmmakers who I just wish would make a film instead of a masterpiece. And then we could see how they're doing. I mean, having said all that, also, I'm terrible with names. I quite like the guys who made, what is that movie? Their latest movie is Cherry, which I haven't seen. And
I can't help you here.
Yeah, I'd have to do a look. Christopher
okay, well,
Nolan
look up Cherry.
Okay.
If you're listening, look up Cherry. Do you
right.
find it? How about a film that none of us have seen, but we should?
None of you have seen. But, well, I mean, Best Years of Our Lives? Go see it if you
yeah,
haven't.
Yeah, that might be
Contemporary films? You know, I'm a historian, and I have to say my heart belongs to the studio system. So I've been – it's tough. Like, if I'm comparing contemporary films to, like, the films that I truly, truly love, like the great, great films of the studio era, you look at, I don't know, Vincent Minnelli movies, nobody – there is no competition. I've been teaching the musical right now, so I am watching films that I've been watching B musicals that are not well known, maybe not very good, but damn, they are entertaining. And so I can recommend here's a clunker, Sun Valley Serenade with Sonia Henie, who is an ice skater. She made ice skating musicals, invented the ice capades. She's not much of a singer, kind of a terrible actress. But that movie just works. and it works despite itself. What I quite like about it is it shows how strong that system was, that they can make a toe-tapping, absorbing musical around an ice skater.
That's pretty good. Well, they don't have to go to Decider now. Everybody who's listening to this can rush off and find these films. And I want to thank you so much, Scott Higgins. Of course, Wesleyan University, the director of the College of Film and the Moving Image, and what a great reputation Wesleyan has, so well regarded around the country, and deservedly so. Thank you so much for being with us today on America Trends.
Thank you. It's been a lot of fun.